19. Thomas Robinson reached around, ran his fingers under his left arm, and lifted it. He guided his arm to the Bible, and his rubber-like left hand sought contact with the black binding. As he raised his right hand, the useless one slipped off the Bible and hit the clerk's table. He was trying again when Judge Taylor growled, "That'll do, Tom." Tom took the oath and stepped into the witness chair. Atticus very quickly induced him to tell us. Tom was 25 years of age. He was married with 3 children. He had been in trouble with the law before. He once received 30 days for disorderly conduct. "It must have been disorderly," said Atticus. "What did it consist of?" "Got in a fight with another man. He tried to cut me."
"Did he succeed?"
"Yes, sir. A little. Not enough to hurt. You see, I..." Tom moved his left shoulder. "Yes," said Atticus. "You were both convicted?"
"Yes, sir. I had to serve 'cause I couldn't pay the fine. Other fella paid his'n."
Dill leaned across me and asked Jim what Atticus was doing. Jim said Atticus was showing the jury that Tom had nothing to hide.
"Were you acquainted with Mayella Violet Yule?" asked Atticus.
"Yes, sir. I had to pass her place going to and from the field every day."
"Whose field?"
"I picks for Mr. Link D's."
"Were you picking cotton in November?"
"No, sir. I works in his yard fall and winter time. I works pretty steady for him all year round. He's got a lot of pecan trees and things."
"You say you had to pass the Yule place to get to and from work. Is there any other way to go?"
"No, sir. None's I know of."
"Tom, did she ever speak to you?"
"Why, yes, sir. I'd tip my hat when I'd go by. One day she asked me to come inside the fence and bust up a chifferobe for her."
"When did she ask you to chop up the chifferobe?"
"Mr. Finch, it was way last spring. I remember it because it was chopping time, and I had my hoe with me. I said I didn't have nothing but this hoe, but she said she had a hatchet. She give me the hatchet, and I broke up the chifferobe. She said, 'I reckon I'll have to give you a nickel, won't I?' I said, 'No, ma'am, there ain't no charge.' Then I went home."
"Mr. Finch, that was way last spring, way over a year ago."
"Did you ever go on to the place again?"
"Yes, sir."
"When?"
"Well, I went lots of times."
Judge Taylor instinctively reached for his gavel, but let his hand fall. The murmur below us died without his help.
"Under what circumstances?"
"Please, sir?
Why did you go inside the fence lots of times?"
Tom Robinson's forehead relaxed.
"She'd call me in, sir. Seemed like every time I passed by yonder, she'd have some little something for me to do. Chopping kindling, toting water for her. She watered them red flowers every day."
"Were you paid for your services?"
"No, sir. Not after she offered me a nickel the first time. I was glad to do it. Mr. Yule didn't seem to help her none, and neither did the chillen, and I knowed she didn't have no nickels to spare."
"Where were the other children?"
"They was always around, all over the place. They'd watch me work, some of 'em. Some of 'em set in the window."
"Would Miss Mayella talk to you?"
"Yes, sir. She talked to me."
As Tom Robinson gave his testimony, it came to me that Mayella Yule must have been the loneliest person in the world. She was even lonelier than Boo Radley, who had not been out of the house in 25 years. When Atticus asked, had she any friends, she seemed not to know what he meant. Then she thought he was making fun of her. She was as sad, I thought, as what Jim called a mixed child. White people wouldn't have anything to do with her because she lived among pigs. Negroes wouldn't have anything to do with her because she was white. She couldn't live like Mr. Dolphus Raymond, who preferred the company of Negroes because she didn't own a river bank and she wasn't from a fine old family. Nobody said, "That's just their way," about the Yules. Makem gave them Christmas baskets, welfare money, and the back of its hand. Tom Robinson was probably the only person who was ever decent to her, but she said he took advantage of her, and when she stood up, she looked at him as if he were dirt beneath her feet. "Did you ever," Atticus interrupted my meditations, "at any time, go on the Yule property? Did you ever set foot on the Yule property without an express invitation from one of them?" "No, sir, Mr. Finch, I never did. I wouldn't do that, sir." Atticus sometimes said that one way to tell whether a witness was lying or telling the truth was to listen rather than watch. I applied his test. Tom denied it 3 times in one breath, but quietly, with no hint of whining in his voice, and I found myself believing him in spite of his protesting too much. He seemed to be a respectable Negro, and a respectable Negro would never go up into somebody's yard of his own volition. "Tom, what happened to you on the evening of November 21st of last year?" Below us, the spectators drew a collective breath and leaned forward. Behind us, the Negroes did the same. Tom was a black velvet Negro, not shiny, but soft black velvet. The whites of his eyes shone in his face, and when he spoke, we saw flashes of his teeth. If he had been whole, he would have been a fine specimen of a man. "Mr. Finch," he said, "I was going home as usual that evening, and when I passed the Yule place, Miss Mayella were on the porch, like she said she were. It seemed real quiet-like, and I didn't quite know why. I was studying why, just passing by when she says for me to come there and help her for a minute. Well, I went inside the fence and looked around for some kindling to work on, but I didn't see none. And she says, 'No, I got something for you to do in the house. That old door's off its hinges and fall's coming on pretty fast.' I said, 'You got a screwdriver, Miss Mayella?' She said she sure had. Well, I went up the steps, and she motioned me to come inside, and I went in the front room and looked at the door. I said, 'Miss Mayella, this door look all right.' I pulled it back and forth, and those hinges was all right. Then she shut the door in my face. Mr. Finch, I was wondering why it was so quiet-like, and it come to me that there wasn't a child on the place, not a one of 'em. And I said, 'Miss Mayella, where are the chillen?'" Tom's black velvet skin had begun to shine, and he ran his hand over his face. "I say, 'Where are the chillen?'" he continued. "And she says, she was laughing, sort of. She says, 'They all gone to town to get ice creams.' She says, 'Took me a slap year to save 7 nickels, but I done it. They all gone to town.'" Tom's discomfort was not from the humidity. "What did you say then, Tom?" asked Atticus. "I said something like, 'Why, Miss Mayella, that's right smart of you to treat 'em.' And she said, 'You think so?' I don't think she understood what I was thinking. I mean, it was smart of her to save like that, and nice of her to treat 'em." "I understand you, Tom. Go on," said Atticus. "Well, I said I'd best be going. I couldn't do nothing for her. And she says, 'Oh, yes, I could.' And I ask her what. And she says to just step on that chair yonder and get that box down from on top of the chiffer robe.
"'Not the same Shiprobe you busted up?' asked Atticus. The witness smiled. "'No, sir. Another one. Most as tall as the room. So I done what she told me, and I was just reaching when the next thing I knows, she'd grabbed me round the legs. Grabbed me round the legs, Mr. Finch.' She scared me so bad I hopped down and turned the chair over. That was the only thing, only furniture, stubbed in that room, Mr. Finch, when I left it. I swear for God.
What happened after you turned the chair over?
Tom Robinson had come to a dead stop. He glanced at Atticus, then at the jury, then at Mr. Underwood sitting across the room.
"'Tom, you're sworn to tell the whole truth. Will you tell it?'
Tom ran his hand nervously over his mouth.
"'What happened after that?'
"'Answer the question,' said Judge Taylor. One-third of his cigar had vanished.
"'Mr. Finch, I got down off of that chair and turned around, and she... "'sort of jumped on me.
"'Jumped on you?
"'Violently? "'No, sir. "'She hugged me. "'She hugged me round the waist.'
"'This time Judge Taylor's gavel came down with a bang, "'and as it did, the overhead lights went on in the courtroom. "'Darkness had not come.' But the afternoon sun had left the windows. Judge Taylor quickly restored order. Then what did she do? The witness swallowed hard.
She reached up and kissed me side of the face. She says she never kissed a grown man before, and she might as well kiss a nigger. She says what her papa do to her don't count. She says, "'Kiss me back, nigger. "'I say, Miss Mayella let me out of here and tried to run. "'But she got her back to the door, and I'd a had to push her. "'I didn't want to harm her, Mr. Finch, and I say, let me pass. "'But just when I say it, Mr. Yule yonder hollered through the window.
"'What did he say?' "'Tom Robinson swallowed again.' "'And his eyes widened. "'Something not fitting to say, "'not fitting for these folks and chillin' to hear. "'What did he say, Tom? "'You must tell the jury what he said. "'Tom Robinson shut his eyes tight. "'He says, you goddamn whore, I'll kill ya. "'Then what happened?'
"'Mr. Finch, I was running so fast, I didn't know what happened.
"'Tom, did you rape Mayella Yule?'
"'I did not, sir.
"'Did you harm her in any way?'
"'I did not, sir.
"'Did you resist her advances?'
"'Mr. Finch, I tried to... "'Without being ugly to her, I didn't want to be ugly. "'I didn't want to push her or nothing.
"'It occurred to me that in their own way, "'Tom Robinson's manners were as good as Atticus's. "'Until my father explained it to me later, "'I did not understand the subtlety of Tom's predicament. "'He would not have dared strike a white woman under any circumstances, and expect to live long, so he took the first opportunity to run, a sure sign of guilt. "'Tom, go back once more to Mr. Yule,' said Atticus. "'Did he say anything to you?'
"'Not anything, sir. He might have said something, but I weren't there.'
"'That'll do.' Atticus cut in sharply. "'What you did hear, who was he talking to?'
Mr. Finch. He were talking and looking at Miss Mayella.
Then you ran?
I sure did, sir.
Why did you run?
I was scared, sir.
Why were you scared?
Mr. Finch, if you was a nigger like me, you'd be scared, too.
Atticus sat down. Mr. Gilmer was making his way to the witness stand, but before he got there, Mr. Link Dees rose from the audience and announced, "I just want the whole lot of you to know one thing right now. That boy's worked for me 8 years, and I ain't had a speck of trouble out of him. Not a speck." "Shut your mouth, sir." Judge Taylor was wide awake and roaring. He was also pink in the face. His speech was miraculously unimpaired by his cigar. "Link Dees," he yelled, "if you have anything you want to say, you can say it under oath and at the proper time. But until then, you get out of this room. You hear me? Get out of this room, sir. You hear me? I'll be damned if I'll listen to this case again." Judge Taylor looked daggers at Atticus, as if daring him to speak. But Atticus had ducked his head and was laughing into his lap. I remembered something he had said about Judge Taylor's ex cathedra remarks sometimes exceeding his duty, but that few lawyers ever did anything about them. I looked at Jim, but Jim shook his head. "It ain't like one of the jurymen got up and started talking," he said. "I think it'd be different then. Mr. Link was just disturbing the peace or something." Judge Taylor told the reporter to expunge anything he happened to have written down after, "Mr. Finch, if you were a nigger like me, you'd be scared too," and told the jury to disregard the interruption. He looked suspiciously down the middle aisle and waited, I suppose for Mr. Link Dees, to effect total departure. Then he said, "Go ahead, Mr. Gilmer." "You were given 30 days once for disorderly conduct, Robinson?" asked Mr. Gilmer.
"Yes, sir."
"What'd the nigger look like when you got through with him?"
"He beat me, Mr. Gilmer."
"Yes, but you were convicted, weren't you?"
Atticus raised his head.
"It was a misdemeanor, and it's in the record, Judge."
I thought he sounded tired.
"Witness'll answer, though," said Judge Taylor, just as wearily.
"Yes, sir. I got 30 days.
I knew that Mr. Gilmer would sincerely tell the jury that anyone who was convicted of disorderly conduct could easily have had it in his heart to take advantage of Mayella Ewell. That was the only reason he cared. Reasons like that helped.
"Robinson, you're pretty good at busting up shifferobes and kindling with one hand, aren't you?"
"Yes, sir, I reckon so."
"Strong enough to choke the breath out of a woman and sling her to the floor?"
"I never done that, sir."
"But you are strong enough to."
"I reckon so, sir."
"Had your eye on her a long time, hadn't you, boy?"
"No, sir, I never looked at her."
"Then you were mighty polite to do all that chopping and hauling for her, weren't you, boy?"
"I was just trying to help her out, sir."
"That was mighty generous of you. You had chores at home after your regular work, didn't you?"
"Yes, sir."
"Why didn't you do them instead of Miss Ewell's?"
"I done 'em both, sir."
"You must have been pretty busy. Why?"
"Why what, sir?"
"Why were you so anxious to do that woman's chores?"
Tom Robinson hesitated, searching for an answer.
"Looked like she didn't have anybody to help her, like I says.
With Mr. Ewell and 7 children on the place, boy?"
"Well, I says it looked like they never help her none."
"You did all this chopping and work from sheer goodness, boy?"
"Tried to help her, I says."
Mr. Gilmer smiled grimly at the judge. "You're a mighty good fellow, it seems. Did all this for not one penny?"
"Yes, sir. I felt right sorry for her. She seemed to try more than the rest of them."
"You felt sorry for her? You felt sorry for her?" Mr. Gilmer seemed ready to rise to the ceiling. The witness realized his mistake and shifted uncomfortably in the chair. But the damage was done. Below us, nobody liked Tom Robinson's answer. Mr. Gilmer paused a long time to let it sink in. "Now, you went by the house as usual last November 21st, he said, "and she asked you to come in and bust up a chiffarobe?"
"No, sir." "Do you deny that you went by the house?"
"No, sir. She said she had something for me to do inside the house." "She says she asked you to bust up a chiffarobe. Is that right?"
"No, sir, it ain't."
"Then you say she's lying, boy?" Atticus was on his feet, but Tom Robinson didn't need him.
"I don't say she's lying, Mr. Gilmer. I say she's mistaken in her mind."
To the next 10 questions, as Mr. Gilmer reviewed Mayella's version of events, the witness's steady answer was that she was mistaken in her mind. "Didn't Mr. Yule run you off the place, boy?"
"No, sir. I don't think he did."
"Don't think? What do you mean?"
"I mean I didn't stay long enough for him to run me off."
"You're very candid about this. Why did you run so fast?"
"I says I was scared, sir."
"If you had a clear conscience, why were you scared?"
"Like I says before, it weren't safe for any nigger to be in a fix like that."
"But you weren't in a fix. You testified that you were resisting Miss Yule. Were you so scared that she'd hurt you? You ran, a big buck like you?"
"No, sir. I scared I'd be in court, just like I am now."
"Scared of arrest? Scared you'd have to face up to what you did?"
"No, sir. Scared I'd have to face up to what I didn't do."
"Are you being impudent to me, boy?"
"No, sir. I didn't go to be."
This was as much as I heard of Mr. Gilmer's cross-examination, because Jim made me take Dill out. For some reason, Dill had started crying and couldn't stop. Quietly at first, then his sobs were heard by several people in the balcony. Jim said if I didn't go with him, he'd make me, and Reverend Sykes said I'd better go. So I went. Dill had seemed to be all right that day, nothing wrong with him, but I guessed he hadn't fully recovered from running away. "Ain't you feeling good?" I asked when we reached the bottom of the stairs. Dill tried to pull himself together as we ran down the south steps. Mr. Link Dees was a lonely figure on the top step. "Anything happening, Scout?" he asked as we went by.
"No, sir," I answered over my shoulder. "Dill here, he's sick."
"Come on out under the trees," I said. "Heat got you, I expect." We chose the fattest live oak, and we sat under it. "It was just him I couldn't stand," Dill said.
"Who, Tom?"
"That old Mr. Gilmer doing him that-a-way, talking so hateful to him."
"Dill, that's his job. Why, if we didn't have prosecutors, well, we couldn't have defense attorneys, I reckon."
Dill exhaled patiently. "I know all that, Scout. It was the way he said it made me sick. Plain sick."
"He's supposed to act that way, Dill. He was cross. He didn't act that way when...
Dale, those were his own witnesses.
Well, Mr. Finch didn't act that way to Mayella and old man Ewell when he cross-examined them. The way that man called him boy all the time and sneered at him and looked around at the jury every time he answered.
Well, Dale, after all, he's just a Negro.
I don't care one speck. It ain't right. Somehow it ain't right to do him that way. Hasn't anybody got any business talking like that? It just makes me sick.
That's just Mr. Gilmer's way, Dale. He does 'em all that way. You've never seen him get good and down on one yet. Why, when... Well, today, Mr. Gilmer seemed to me like he wasn't half trying. They do 'em all that way. Most lawyers, I mean. Mr. Finch doesn't.
He's not an example, Dale. He's... I was trying to grope in my memory for a sharp phrase of Miss Maudie Atkinson's. I had it. He's the same in the courtroom as he is on the public streets.
That's not what I mean, said Dill.
I know what you mean, boy, said a voice behind us. We thought it came from the tree trunk, but it belonged to Mr. Dolphus Raymond. He peered around the trunk at us. You aren't thin-hided. It just makes you sick, doesn't it?
20.
Come on round here, son. I got something that'll settle your stomach.
As Mr. Dolphus Raymond was an evil man, I accepted his invitation reluctantly, but I followed Dill. Somehow, I didn't think Atticus would like it if we became friendly with Mr. Raymond, and I knew Aunt Alexandra wouldn't.
"Here," he said, offering Dill his paper sack with straws in it. "Take a good sip. It'll quieten you."
Dill sucked on the straws, smiled, and pulled at length.
"Ha-ha," said Mr. Raymond, evidently taking delight in corrupting a child.
"Dill, you watch out now," I warned.
Dill released the straws and grinned. "Scout, it's nothing but Coca-Cola." Mr. Raymond sat up against the tree trunk. He had been lying on the grass. "You little folks won't tell on me now, will you? It'd ruin my reputation if you did."
"You mean all you drink in that sack's Coca-Cola? Just plain Coca-Cola?"
"Yes, ma'am," Mr. Raymond nodded. I liked his smell. It was of leather, horses, cottonseed. He wore the only English riding boots I had ever seen. "That's all I drink most of the time."
"Then you just pretend you're half—" "I beg your pardon, sir." I caught myself. "I didn't mean to be—"
Mr. Raymond chuckled, not at all offended, and I tried to frame a discreet question. "Why do you do like you do?"
"Oh, yes, you mean why do I pretend? Well, it's very simple," he said. "Some folks don't like the way I live. Now, I could say the hell with them. I don't care if they don't like it." "I do say I don't care if they don't like it, right enough, but I don't say the hell with them. See?"
Dill and I said, "No, sir."
"I try to give them a reason, you see. It helps folks if they can latch on to a reason. When I come to town, which is seldom, if I weave a little and drink out of this sack, folks can say Dolphus Raymond's in the clutches of whiskey. That's why he won't change his ways. He can't help himself. That's why he lives the way he does."
"That ain't honest, Mr. Raymond, making yourself out badder than you are already."
"It ain't honest, but it's mighty helpful to folks. Secretly, Miss Finch, I'm not much of a drinker, but you see, they could never, never understand that I live like I do because that's the way I want to live."
I had a feeling that I shouldn't be here listening to this sinful man who had mixed children and didn't care who knew it. But he was fascinating. I had never encountered a being who deliberately perpetrated fraud against himself. But why had he entrusted us with his deepest secret? I asked him why. "Because you're children, and you can understand it," he said,
and because I heard that one...
He jerked his head at Dill.
Things haven't caught up with that one's instinct yet. Let him get a little older and he won't get sick and cry. Maybe things will strike him as being not quite right, say, but he won't cry. Not when he gets a few years on him.
Cry about what, Mr. Raymond?
Dill's maleness was beginning to assert itself.
Cry about the simple hell people give other people, without even thinking.
Cry about the hell white people give colored folks, without even stopping to think that they're people, too.
Attica says cheating a colored man's 10 times worse than cheating a white man, I muttered. Says it's the worst thing you can do.
Mr. Raymond said, I don't reckon it's...
Miss Jean Louise, you don't know your pa's not a run-of-the-mill man. It'll take a few years for that to sink in. You haven't seen enough of the world yet. You haven't even seen this town. But all you got to do is step back inside the courthouse.
Which reminded me that we were missing nearly all of Mr. Gilmer's cross-examination. I looked at the sun, and it was dropping fast behind the store tops on the west side of the square. Between two fires, I could not decide which I wanted to jump into, Mr. Raymond or the 5th Judicial Circuit Court. Come on, Dill, I said. You all right now?
Yeah. Glad to have met you, Mr. Raymond, and thanks for the drink. It was mighty settling.
We raced back to the courthouse, up the steps, up 2 flights of stairs, and edged our way along the balcony rail. Reverend Sykes had saved our seats. The courtroom was still, and again I wondered where the babies were. Judge Taylor's cigar was a brown speck in the center of his mouth. Mr. Gilmer was writing on one of the yellow pads on his table, trying to outdo the court reporter, whose hand was jerking rapidly.
Shoot, I muttered, we missed it.
Atticus was halfway through his speech to the jury. He had evidently pulled some papers from his briefcase that rested beside his chair because they were on his table. Tom Robinson was toying with them.
Absence of any corroborative evidence, this man was indicted on a capital charge and is now on trial for his life.
I punched Jim. How long's he been at it?
He's just gone over the evidence, Jim whispered, and we're gonna win, Scout. I don't see how we can't. He's been at it about 5 minutes. He made it as plain and easy as... Well, as Ida explained it to you, you could have understood it even. Did Mr. Gilmer... Shh! Nothing new, just the usual. Hush now.
We looked down again. Atticus was speaking easily, with the kind of detachment he used when he dictated a letter. He walked slowly up and down in front of the jury, and the jury seemed to be attentive. Their heads were up, and they followed Atticus's route with what seemed to be appreciation. I guess it was because Atticus wasn't a thunderer. Atticus paused. Then he did something he didn't ordinarily do. He unhitched his watch and chain and placed them on the table, saying, "With the court's permission." Judge Taylor nodded, and then Atticus did something I never saw him do before or since, in public or in private. He unbuttoned his vest, unbuttoned his collar, loosened his tie, and took off his coat. He never loosened a scrap of his clothing until he undressed at bedtime, and to Jim and me, this was the equivalent of him standing before us stark naked. We exchanged horrified glances. Atticus put his hands in his pockets, and as he returned to the jury, I saw his gold collar button and the tips of his pen and pencil winking in the light.
"Gentlemen," he said.
Jim and I again looked at each other. Atticus might have said scout. His voice had lost its aridity, its detachment, and he was talking to the jury as if they were folks on the post office corner.
"Gentlemen," he was saying, "I shall be brief.
but I would like to use my remaining time with you to remind you that this case is not a difficult one. It requires no minute sifting of complicated facts, but it does require you to be sure, beyond all reasonable doubt, as to the guilt of the defendant. To begin with, this case should never have come to trial. This case is as simple as black and white. The state has not produced one iota of medical evidence to the effect that the crime Tom Robinson is charged with ever took place. It has relied instead upon the testimony of two witnesses whose evidence has not only been called into serious question on cross-examination, but has been flatly contradicted by the defendant. The defendant is not guilty, but somebody in this courtroom is. I have nothing but pity in my heart for the chief witness for the state, but my pity does not extend so far as to her putting a man's life at stake, which she has done in an effort to get rid of her own guilt. I say guilt, gentlemen, because it was guilt that motivated her. She has committed no crime. She has merely broken a rigid and time-honored code of our society, a code so severe that whoever breaks it is hounded from our midst as unfit to live with. She is the victim of cruel poverty and ignorance, but I cannot pity her. She is white. She knew full well the enormity of her offense, but because her desires were stronger than the code she was breaking, she persisted in breaking it. She persisted as her subsequent reaction is something that all of us have known at one time or another. She did something every child has done. She tried to put the evidence of her offense away from her. But in this case, she was no child hiding stolen contraband. She struck out at her victim. Of necessity, she must put him away from her. He must be removed from her presence, from this world. She must destroy the evidence of her offense. What was the evidence of her offense? Tom Robinson, a human being. She must put Tom Robinson away from her. Tom Robinson was her daily reminder of what she did. What did she do? She tempted a Negro. She was white, and she tempted a Negro. She did something that in our society is unspeakable. She kissed a black man. Not an old uncle, but a strong, young Negro man. No code mattered to her before she broke it, but it came crashing down on her afterwards. Her father saw it, and the defendant has testified as to his remarks. What did her father do? We don't know. But there is circumstantial evidence to indicate that Mayella Ewell was beaten savagely by someone who led almost exclusively with his left. We do know in part what Mr. Ewell did. He did what any God-fearing, persevering, respectable white man would do under the circumstances. He swore out a warrant, no doubt signing it with his left hand. And Tom Robinson now sits before you, having taken the oath with the only good hand he possesses, his right hand. And so a quiet, respectable, humble Negro
who had the unmitigated temerity to feel sorry for a white woman, has had to put his word against two white people's. I need not remind you of their appearance and conduct on the stand. You saw them for yourselves. The witnesses for the state, with the exception of the sheriff of Macomb County, have presented themselves to you gentlemen, to this court, in the cynical confidence that their testimony would not be doubted, confident that you gentlemen would go along with them on the assumption, the evil assumption, that all Negroes lie, that all Negroes are basically immoral beings, that all Negro men are not to be trusted around our women, an assumption one associates with minds of their caliber. Which, gentlemen, we know is in itself a lie as black as Tom Robinson's skin. A lie I do not have to point out to you. You know the truth, and the truth is this. Some Negroes lie. Some Negroes are immoral. Some Negro men are not to be trusted around women, black or white. But this is a truth that applies to the human race and to no particular race of men. There is not a person in this courtroom who has never told a lie, who has never done an immoral thing. And there is no man living who has never looked upon a woman without desire. Atticus paused and took out his handkerchief. Then he took off his glasses and wiped them. And we saw another first. We had never seen him sweat. He was one of those men whose faces never perspired, but now it was shining tan. One more thing, gentlemen, before I quit. Thomas Jefferson once said that all men are created equal, a phrase that the Yankees and the distaff side of the executive branch in Washington are fond of hurling at us. There is a tendency in this year of grace, 1935, for certain people to use this phrase out of context to satisfy all conditions. The most ridiculous example I can think of is that the people who run public education promote the stupid and idle along with the industrious. Because all men are created equal, educators will gravely tell you, the children left behind suffer terrible feelings of inferiority. We know all men are not created equal in the sense some people would have us believe. Some people are smarter than others. Some people have more opportunity because they're born with it. Some men make more money than others. Some ladies make better cakes than others. Some people are born gifted beyond the normal scope of most men. But there is one way in this country in which all men are created equal. There is one human institution that makes a pauper the equal of a Rockefeller, the stupid man the equal of an Einstein, and the ignorant man the equal of any college president. That institution, gentlemen, is a court. It can be the Supreme Court of the United States, or the humblest J.P. court in the land, or this honorable court which you serve. Our courts have their faults, as does any human institution, but in this country, our courts are the great levelers, and in our courts, all men are created equal. I'm no idealist to believe firmly in the integrity of our courts and in the jury system. That is no ideal to me. It is a living, working reality. Gentlemen, a court is no better than each man of you sitting before me on this jury. A court is only as sound as its jury, and a jury is only as sound as the men who make it up. I am confident that you gentlemen will review without passion the evidence you have heard, come to a decision, and restore this defendant to his family. In the name of God, do your duty. Atticus's voice had dropped, and as he turned away from the jury, he said something I did not catch. He said it more to himself than to the court. I punched Jim. What did he say? In the name of God, believe him. I think that's what he said. Dill suddenly reached over me and tugged at Jim. Look yonder. We followed his finger with sinking hearts. Calpurnia was making her way up the middle aisle, walking straight toward Atticus. 21. She stopped shyly at the railing and waited to get Judge Taylor's attention. She was in a fresh apron and she carried an envelope in her hand. Judge Taylor saw her and said, "It's Calpurnia, isn't it?" "Yes, sir," she said. "Could I just pass this note to Mr. Finch, please, sir? It hasn't got anything to do with the trial." Judge Taylor nodded, and Atticus took the envelope from Calpurnia. He opened it, read its contents, and said, "Judge, this note is from my sister. She says my children are missing. Haven't turned up since noon. I know where they are, Atticus," Mr. Underwood spoke up. "They're right up yonder in the colored balcony. Been there since precisely 1:18 p.m. Our father turned around and looked up. "Jim, come down from there," he called. Then he said something to the judge we didn't hear. We climbed across Reverend Sykes and made our way to the staircase. Atticus and Calpurnia met us downstairs. Calpurnia looked peeved, but Atticus looked exhausted. Jim was jumping in excitement. "We've won, haven't we?" "I've no idea," said Atticus shortly. "You've been here all afternoon? Go home with Calpurnia and get your supper. And stay home."
"Aw, Atticus, let us come back," pleaded Jim. "Please let us hear the verdict. Please, sir."
The jury might be out and back in a minute. We don't know. But we could tell Atticus was relenting. "Well, you've heard it all, so you might as well hear the rest. Tell you what, you all can come back when you've eaten your supper. Eat slowly now. You won't miss anything important. And if the jury's still out, you can wait with us. But I expect it'll be over before you get back."
"You think they'll acquit him that fast?" asked Jim.
Atticus opened his mouth to answer, but shut it and left us. I prayed that Reverend Sykes would save our seats for us, but stopped praying when I remembered that people got up and left in droves when the jury was out. Tonight, they'd overrun the drugstore, the OK Cafe, and the hotel. That is, unless they had brought their suppers, too. Calpurnia marched us home. "Skin every one of you alive, the very idea. You children listening to all that. Mr. Jim, don't you know better'n to take your little sister to that trial? Miss Alexandra'll absolutely have a stroke of paralysis when she finds out. Ain't fitting for children to hear." The streetlights were on, and we glimpsed Calpurnia's indignant profile as we passed beneath them. "Mr. Jim, I thought you was getting some kind of head on your shoulders. The very idea. She's your little sister. The very idea, sir. You ought to be perfectly ashamed of yourself. Ain't you got any sense at all?" I was exhilarated. So many things had happened so fast, I felt it would take years to sort them out. And now here was Calpurnia giving her precious Jim down the country. What new marvels would the evening bring? Jim was chuckling. "Don't you want to hear about it, Cal?" "Hush your mouth, sir. When you ought to be hanging your head in shame, you go along laughing. Calpurnia revived a series of rusty threats that moved Jim to little remorse, and she sailed up the front steps with her classic, "If Mr. Finch don't wear you out, I will. Get in that house, sir." Jim went in grinning, and Calpurnia nodded tacit consent to having Dill in to supper. "You all call Miss Rachel right now and tell her where you are," she told him. "She's run distracted looking for you. You watch out she don't ship you back to Meridian first thing in the morning." Aunt Alexandra met us and nearly fainted when Calpurnia told her where we were. I guess it hurt her when we told her Attica said we could go back, because she didn't say a word during supper. She just rearranged food on her plate, looking at it sadly, while Calpurnia served Jim, Dill, and me with a vengeance. Calpurnia poured milk, dished out potato salad and ham, muttering, "Shamed of yourselves," in varying degrees of intensity. "Now you all eat slow," was her final command. Reverend Sykes had saved our places. We were surprised to find that we had been gone nearly an hour, and were equally surprised to find the courtroom exactly as we had left it, with minor changes. The jury box was empty. The defendant was gone. Judge Taylor had been gone, but he reappeared as we were seating ourselves. "Nobody's moved hardly," said Jim. "They moved around some when the jury went out," said Reverend Sykes. "The men folk down there got the women folk their suppers, and they fed their babies." "How long have they been out?" asked Jim. "About 30 minutes. Mr. Finch and Mr. Gilmer did some more talking, and Judge Taylor charged the jury." "How was he?" asked Jim. "What say?" "Oh, he did right well. I ain't complaining one bit. He was mighty fair-minded. He sort of said, 'If you believe this, then you'll have to return one verdict, but if you believe this, you'll have to return another one.' I thought he was leaning a little to our side." Reverend Sykes scratched his head. Jim smiled. "He's not supposed to lean, Reverend, but don't fret. We've won it," he said wisely. "Don't see how any jury could convict on what we heard." "Now don't you be so confident, Mr. Jim. I ain't ever seen any jury decide in favor of a colored man over a white man." But Jim took exception to Reverend Sykes, and we were subjected to a lengthy review of the evidence with Jim's ideas on the law regarding rape. It wasn't rape if she let you, but she had to be 18, in Alabama, that is, and Mayella was 19. Apparently you had to kick and holler. You had to be overpowered and stomped on, preferably knocked stone cold. If you were under 18, you didn't have to go through all this. "Mr. Jim," Reverend Sykes demurred, "this ain't a polite thing for little ladies to hear." "Oh, she doesn't know what we're talking about," said Jim. "Scal, this is too old for you, ain't it?" "It most certainly is not. I know every word you're saying." Perhaps I was too convincing, because Jim hushed and never discussed the subject again. "What time is it, Reverend?" he asked. "Getting on toward 8. I looked down and saw Attica strolling around with his hands in his pockets. He made a tour of the windows, then walked by the railing over to the jury box. He looked in it, inspected Judge Taylor on his throne, then went back to where he started. I caught his eye and waved to him. He acknowledged my salute with a nod and resumed his tour. Mr. Gilmer was standing at the windows talking to Mr. Underwood. Bert, the court reporter, was chain-smoking. He sat back with his feet on the table. But the officers of the court, the ones present, Atticus, Mr. Gilmer, Judge Taylor, sound asleep, and Bert, were the only ones whose behavior seemed normal. I had never seen a packed courtroom so still. Sometimes a baby would cry out fretfully, and a child would scurry out, but the grown people sat as if they were in church. In the balcony, The Negroes sat and stood around us with biblical patience. The old courthouse clock suffered its preliminary strain and struck the hour, 8 deafening bongs that shook our bones. When it bonged 11 times, I was past feeling, tired from fighting sleep. I allowed myself a short nap against Reverend Sykes' comfortable arm and shoulder. I jerked awake and made an honest effort to remain so by looking down and concentrating on the heads below. There were 16 bald ones, 14 men that could pass for redheads, 40 heads varying between brown and black, and I remembered something Jim had once explained to me when he went through a brief period of psychical research. He said if enough people, a stadium full maybe, were to concentrate on one thing, such as setting a tree afire in the woods, that the tree would ignite of its own accord. I toyed with the idea of asking everyone below to concentrate on setting Tom Robinson free, but thought if they were as tired as I, it wouldn't work. Dill was sound asleep, his head on Jim's shoulder, and Jim was quiet. "Ain't it a long time?" I asked him. "Sure is, Scout," he said happily. "Well, from the way you put it, it'd just take 5 minutes." Jim raised his eyebrows. "There are things you don't understand," he said, and I was too weary to argue. But I must have been reasonably awake, or I would not have received the impression that was creeping into me. It was not unlike one I had last winter, and I shivered, though the night was hot. The feeling grew until the atmosphere in the courtroom was exactly the same as a cold February morning when the mockingbirds were still and the carpenters had stopped hammering on Miss Maudie's new house and every wood door in the neighborhood was shut as tight as the doors of the Radley place. A deserted, waiting, empty street, and the courtroom was packed with people. A steaming summer night was no different from a winter morning. Mr. Heck Tate, who had entered the courtroom and was talking to Atticus, might have been wearing his high boots and lumber jacket. Atticus had stopped his tranquil journey and had put his foot onto the bottom rung of a chair. As he listened to what Mr. Tate was saying, he ran his hand slowly up and down his thigh. I expected Mr. Tate to say any minute, "Take him, Mr. Finch." But Mr. Tate said, "This court will come to order," in a voice that rang with authority, and the heads below us jerked up. Mr. Tate left the room and returned with Tom Robinson. He steered Tom to his place beside Atticus and stood there. Judge Taylor had roused himself to a sudden alertness and was sitting up straight, looking at the empty jury box. What happened after that had a dreamlike quality. In a dream, I saw the jury return, moving like underwater swimmers, and Judge Taylor's voice came from far away and was tiny. I saw something only a lawyer's child could be expected to see, could be expected to watch for, and it was like watching Atticus walk into the street, raise a rifle to his shoulder, and pull the trigger, but watching all the time, knowing that the gun was empty. A jury never looks at a defendant it has convicted, and when this jury came in, not one of them looked at Tom Robinson. The foreman handed a piece of paper to Mr. Tate, who handed it to the clerk, who handed it to the judge. I shut my eyes. Judge Taylor was polling the jury. "Guilty, guilty, guilty, guilty." I peeked at Jim. His hands were white from gripping the balcony rail, and his shoulders jerked as if each guilty was a separate stab between them. Judge Taylor was saying something. His gavel was in his fist, but he wasn't using it. Dimly, I saw Atticus pushing papers from the table into his briefcase. He snapped it shut, went to the court reporter and said something, nodded to Mr. Gilmer, and then went to Tom Robinson and whispered something to him. Atticus put his hand on Tom's shoulder as he whispered. Atticus took his coat off the back of his chair and pulled it over his shoulder. Then he left the courtroom, but not by his usual exit. He must have wanted to go home the short way, because he walked quickly down the middle aisle toward the south exit. I followed the top of his head as he made his way to the door. He did not look up. Someone was punching me, but I was reluctant to take my eyes from the people below us and from the image of Atticus's lonely walk down the aisle. "Miss Jean Louise?" I looked around. They were standing, all around us and in the balcony on the opposite wall. The Negroes were getting to their feet. Reverend Sykes's voice was as distant as Judge Taylor's. "Miss Jean Louise, stand up. Your father's passing." 22. It was Jim's turn to cry. His face was streaked with angry tears as we made our way through the cheerful crowd. "It ain't right," he muttered all the way to the corner of the square where we found Atticus waiting. Atticus was standing under the streetlight, looking as though nothing had happened. His vest was buttoned, his collar and tie were neatly in place, his watch chain glistened. He was his impassive self again. "It ain't right, Atticus," said Jim. "No, son, it's not right." We walked home. Aunt Alexandra was waiting up. She was in her dressing gown, and I could have sworn she had on her corset underneath it. "I'm sorry, brother," she murmured, having never heard her call Atticus brother before. I stole a glance at Jim, but he was not listening. He would look up at Atticus, then down at the floor, and I wondered if he thought Atticus somehow responsible for Tom Robinson's conviction. "Is he all right?" Auntie asked, indicating Jim. "He'll be so presently," said Atticus. "It was a little too strong for him." Our father sighed. "I'm going to bed," he said. "If I don't wake up in the morning, don't call me." I didn't think it wise in the first place to let them. "This is their home, sister," said Atticus. "We've made it this way for them. They might as well learn to cope with it. But they don't have to go to the courthouse and wallow in it. It's just as much Macomb County as missionary teas." "Atticus," Aunt Alexandra's eyes were anxious, "you are the last person I thought would turn bitter over this." "I'm not bitter, just tired. I'm going to bed." "Atticus," said Jim bleakly. He turned in the doorway. "What, son?" "How could they do it? How could they?" "I don't know, but they did it. They've done it before, and they did it tonight, and they'll do it again. And when they do it, seems that only children weep. Good night." But things are always better in the morning. Atticus rose at his usual ungodly hour and was in the living room behind the mobile register when we stumbled in. Jim's morning face posed the question his sleepy lips struggled to ask. "It's not time to worry yet," Atticus reassured him as we went to the dining room. "We're not through yet. There'll be an appeal, you can count on that. Gracious alive, Cal, what's all this?" He was staring at his breakfast plate. "Calpurnia said, 'Tom Robinson's daddy sent you along this chicken this morning. I fixed it.' You tell him I'm proud to get it. Bet they don't have chicken for breakfast at the White House. What are these?" "Rolls," said Calpurnia, Estelle down at the hotel sent them. Atticus looked up at her, puzzled, and she said, "You better step out here and see what's in the kitchen, Mr. Finch." We followed him. The kitchen table was loaded with enough food to bury the family. Hunks of salt pork, tomatoes, beans, even scuppernongs. Atticus grinned when he found a jar of pickled pig's knuckles. "Reckon Annie'll let me eat these in the dining room?" Calpurnia said, "This was all round the back steps when I got here this morning. They appreciate what you did, Mr. Finch. They aren't overstepping themselves, are they?" Atticus's eyes filled with tears. He did not speak for a moment. "Tell them I'm very grateful," he said. Tell them they must never do this again. Times are too hard." He left the kitchen, went in the dining room, and excused himself to Aunt Alexandra, put on his hat, and went to town. We heard Dill's step in the hall, so Calpurnia left Atticus's uneaten breakfast on the table. Between rabbit bites, Dill told us of Miss Rachel's reaction to last night, which was, if a man like Atticus Finch wants to butt his head against a stone wall, it's his head. "I'd have got her told," growled Dill, gnawing a chicken leg, "but she didn't look much like telling this morning. Said she was up half the night wondering where I was. Said she'd have had the sheriff after me, but he was at the hearing." "Dill, you got to stop going off without telling her," said Jim. "It just aggravates her." Dill sighed patiently. "I told her till I was blue in the face where I was going. She's just seen too many snakes in the closet. But that woman drinks a pint for breakfast every morning. No, she drinks 2 glasses full. Seen her." "Don't talk like that, Dill," said Aunt Alexandra. "It's not becoming to a child. It's cynical." "I ain't cynical, Miss Alexandra. Telling the truth's not cynical, is it?" "The way you tell it, it is." Jim's eyes flashed at her, but he said to Dill, "Let's go. You can take that runner with you." When we went to the front porch, Miss Stephanie Crawford was busy telling it to Miss Maudie Atkinson and Mr. Avery. They looked around at us and went on talking. Jim made a feral noise in his throat. I wished for a weapon. "I hate grown folks looking at you," said Dill. "Makes you feel like you've done something." Miss Maudie yelled for Jim Finch to come there. Jim groaned and heaved himself up from the swing. "We'll go with you," Dill said. Miss Stephanie's nose quivered with curiosity. She wanted to know who all gave us permission to go to court. She didn't see us, but it was all over town this morning that we were in the colored balcony. Did Atticus put us up there as a sort of... wasn't it right close up there with all those... did Scout understand all the... didn't it make us mad to see our daddy beat? Hush, Stephanie. Miss Maudie's diction was deadly. I've not got all the morning to pass on the porch. Jim Finch, I called to find out if you and your colleagues can eat some cake. Got up at 5 to make it, so you better say yes. Excuse us, Stephanie. Good morning, Mr. Avery. There was a big cake and 2 little ones on Miss Maudie's kitchen table. There should have been 3 little ones. It was not like Miss Maudie to forget Dill, and we must have shown it. But we understood when she cut from the big cake and gave the slice to Jim. As we ate, we sensed that this was Miss Maudie's way of saying that as far as she was concerned, nothing had changed. She sat quietly in a kitchen chair, watching us. Suddenly she spoke. "Don't fret, Jim. Things are never as bad as they seem." Indoors, when Miss Maudie wanted to say something lengthy, she spread her fingers on her knees and settled her bridge work. This she did, and we waited. I simply want to tell you that there are some men in this world who were born to do our unpleasant jobs for us. Your father's one of them.
Oh, said Jim.
Well, don't you owe-well me, sir, Miss Maudie replied, recognizing Jim's fatalistic noises. You are not old enough to appreciate what I said. Jim was staring at his half-eaten cake.
It's like being a caterpillar in a cocoon, that's what it is, he said, like something asleep wrapped up in a warm place. I always thought Macomb folks were the best folks in the world, at least that's what they seemed like.
We're the safest folks in the world, said Miss Maudie. We're so rarely called on to be Christians, but when we are, we've got men like Atticus to go for us. Jim grinned ruefully. Wish the rest of the county thought that. You'd be surprised how many of us do.
Who? Jim's voice rose. Who in this town did one thing to help Tom Robinson? Just who?
His colored friends, for one thing, and people like us. People like Judge Taylor, people like Mr. Heck Tate.
Stop eating and start thinking, Jim. Did it ever strike you that Judge Taylor naming Atticus to defend that boy was no accident? That Judge Taylor might have had his reasons for naming him?
This was a thought. Court-appointed defenses were usually given to Maxwell Green, Macomb's latest addition to the bar, who needed the experience. Maxwell Green should have had Tom Robinson's case.
You think about that, Miss Maudie was saying. It was no accident. I was sitting there on the porch last night waiting. I waited and waited to see you all come down the sidewalk, and as I waited, I thought, Atticus Finch won't win. He can't win, but he's the only man in these parts who can keep a jury out so long in a case like that. And I thought to myself, well, we're making a step. It's just a baby step, but it's a step.
It's all right to talk like that. Can any Christian judges and lawyers make up for heathen juries? Jim muttered. Soon's I get grown.
That's something you'll have to take up with your father, Miss Maudie said.
We went down Miss Maudie's cool new steps into the sunshine and found Mr. Avery and Miss Stephanie Crawford still at it. They had moved down the sidewalk and were standing in front of Miss Stephanie's house. Miss Rachel was walking toward them.
I think I'll be a clown when I get grown, said Dill.
Jim and I stopped in our tracks.
Yes, sir, a clown, he said. There ain't one thing in this world I can do about folks except laugh, so I'm going to join the circus and laugh my head off.
You got it backwards, Dill, said Jim. Clowns are sad. It's folks that laugh at them.
Well, I'm going to be a new kind of clown. I'm going to stand in the middle of the ring and laugh at the folks.
Just look yonder, he pointed. Every one of them ought to be riding broomsticks.
Aunt Rachel already does.
Miss Stephanie and Miss Rachel were waving wildly at us in a way that did not give the lie to Dill's observation.
Oh, gosh, breathed Jim. I reckon it'd be ugly not to see him.
Something was wrong. Mr. Avery was red in the face from a sneezing spell and nearly blew us off the sidewalk when we came up. Miss Stephanie was trembling with excitement, and Miss Rachel caught Dill's shoulder.
You get on in the backyard and stay there, she said. There's danger a-coming.
"'S matter? I asked. Ain't you heard yet? It's all over town.
At that moment, Aunt Alexandra came to the door and called us, but she was too late. It was Miss Stephanie's pleasure to tell us. This morning, Mr. Bob Ewell stopped Atticus on the post office corner, spat in his face, and told him he'd get him if it took the rest of his life.